Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Across the planet, vast landscapes are contaminated by the legacy of the nuclear age. From Hiroshima to Hanford and Chernobyl to Fukushima, the growing legacy of lethal radioactive waste has created vast exclusion zones where people have been permanently forced from their homes. Today, we talk with Fred Pierce, author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. We'll take a tour of toxic radioactive wastelands around the world that reveals how humanity's struggle to conquer atomic energy is rife with secrecy, deceit, human error, blatant disregard for life, short-sighted politics, and fear. Fred, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you very much.
It's great to finally get you on. It's only taken us about 15 minutes. It's like the old transcontinental days. Fred is talking to us today from London, England, and he's the author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. Now, when I started reading your book, a lot of the names of these places that are basically radioactive disaster areas around the world were familiar to me from the early days of the anti-nuclear movement in the late 70s, early 80s. When we heard about things like the Windscale fire in England and this horrible thing that happened in the Ural Mountains in Russia and Rocky Flats fire. And this was like common in the lingo of anti-nuclear activists. But these days, I think the only nuclear disasters that people are familiar with are probably Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Fukushima. So why is it important for us to remind people of these other disasters? And I guess that comes to the point of, why did you write this book?
Really, I'm looking at the legacy, I think. I mean, my gut feeling, it's only a gut feeling, is that probably the days of nuclear power, and I'd like to think nuclear weapons, but that's a harder question, the days of nuclear power are coming to a close. Certainly, it's a long time since the U.S. has completed any nuclear power plants. They're being shut down at an increasing rate because the economics no longer add up. And that's true in many countries around the world. Even nuclear enthusiasts like France are shutting down. Germany's completely shutting down. Britain is in a kind of ambivalent state. So my feeling is that we're reaching towards the end of the nuclear age, and we need to start looking at the legacy, what's left behind. And some of that is these contaminated areas, and they're still very contaminated, such as Chernobyl. The huge amount of mess that there is at Hanford that's got to be cleaned up, you know, that's they're spending $2 billion a year on that and not really making much progress. Huge cleanup bills, coupled with the fact that we don't actually have anywhere to put much of the most dangerous waste, the spent fuel from the reactors, the plutonium containing heat generating fuels. So we have a huge range of problems which are going to long outlast, I suspect, are actually getting any energy from nuclear power. So that's, if you like, I'm trying to look at the legacy and see what's going to happen in the 21st century. These are not problems of the past. They're problems of the future.
Well, I read a book a few years ago and actually interviewed the author about Yucca Mountain. And this is an author who lived in Nevada and was like looking at what would it mean, the legacy to that part of Nevada, if Yucca Mountain really became the national, if not international, ultimate final resting place for all of our nuclear waste. And he started talking in terms of, how do you design markers that are going to be meaningful in 24,000 years? And I think that that's the first thing we really need to look at, is what does it mean when you're dealing with an element as incredibly lethal and long-living as plutonium? How do we think in that kind of time frame when we can barely think, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 years ahead of us?
That's one of the fundamental problems, I think, with nuclear energy altogether, is that it poses questions for us that we're not really used to answering or even thinking about. And one of those, as you say, is how to alert people to that we buried nuclear waste that is going to be dangerous. If there was some seismic activity or mining, or who knows what might be going on at that time, how we could find ways of alerting people that there might be a risk there in societies and cultures of which we can't comprehend. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems. I mean, I do believe, contrary to many sort of anti-nuclear people, I do believe that we have to get to grips with this. We probably have to activate the Yucca Mountain Plan or something similar, find places to bury waste as safely as we can, but we have to recognize that there is no ultimate 100% safety, and we are going to have to put in place methods of that sort as best we can manage to alert people to what might be happening way, way down the track, as you say, potentially tens of thousands of years. And that is a problem which is not just a U.S. problem. It's an issue for countries around the world. Britain has been talking about how to dispose of its nuclear waste. The Russians have constant debates about it, and even though they have a state which can basically decide what it wants to do with very little democratic accountability, even they've not managed to solve that problem. And the Japanese and the Chinese coming up, and you know, nobody apart from Finland and Sweden, who are halfway to producing repositories for their small amount of waste, nobody else has come up with a solution.
Well, before we get more into this very cosmic existential question, I wanted to have you talk about some of the lesser known, or they should be equally infamous, but not as well remembered nuclear crises that have happened since. Well, I don't think we really have to talk a lot about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because I think people more or less know about that. But since then, the areas that have been laid to waste, the causes for some of these accidents and what the consequences have been. So if you could do like a whirlwind tour of the places that people don't know about. So we won't talk about Fukushima, we won't talk about Chernobyl, and we won't talk about Three Mile Island, but we'll talk about the others.
Well, there are several in the former Soviet Union, now in Russia, that I knew very little about, and in general, people knew very little about. And the Russian equivalent of Hanford or the Sellafield Windscale plant in the UK, the plutonium-producing centers, which are now becoming centers for handling nuclear waste, is a city, closed city, still called Ozersk, which is behind the Urals, so way away from Western Europe, you know, right in on the edge of Siberia. And interestingly, there was about a month in 1957, at the height of manufacturing of nuclear weapons, at the height of the Cold War, when there were three nuclear accidents in different parts of the world. There was the Windscale fire in the UK. There was a bad fire at the Rocky Flats plutonium fabricating plant in Colorado. And there was a much less famous, in fact, completely unknown for a long time, major accident blowing large amounts of radioactivity across the landscape at Ozersk. I turned out to be the first Western journalist to go into some of the villages that are been turned into an exclusion zone now. It's a kind of precursor to what happened at Chernobyl. And, you know, people were simply evacuated from there without even being told what was going on in any regard, because the plant was a secret plant. And people subsequently had their health monitored over many decades without being told why. And it was only after the collapse of the Soviet Union that people had any inkling of what had been going on. And apart from the accident, they were pouring huge amounts of, I mean, terrifyingly radioactive waste down a local river, which people were using in some cases for their drinking water and filling their samovars for their tea with and all that. So these are immensely contaminated environments in which we know for a fact that, you know, hundreds of people died, and it may well have been much more than that. So that was one which I didn't know about, certainly prior to kind of peeling through the historical record. Interestingly, I found that some of the Russian scientists were now quite keen to talk about it, if only to say that they did things much better these days. So there was information to be gathered there, but it was kind of part of the inherent secrecy of the nuclear industry around the world, which you see in its most kind of frightening form, in the form of the Soviet Union.
Actually, there was a book written about that, I think back in the 80s, and I can't remember the name of it. You mention it in your book. It was a very odd book, and I happened upon it, and I never. And that was when I learned about this incredible, I mean, it's more than an accident. It was
That's
kind
right.
of like...
I mean, we first... Yeah.
Mendeviv.
I learned about it. In fact, on my magazine I worked for subsequently, called New Scientist magazine in the UK, where a Russian dissident wrote a piece which mentioned this, and kind of assumed that people in the West knew about it, because dissident scientists in Russia had got wind of it, and it turned out that nobody knew about it, and this was in I think 1976, if memory serves. So that was the first inkling that we had of it, and then subsequently a few more things came out. Western scientists started to try and piece together what had happened, but the Russian people didn't learn about it until after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
No, actually, the scientist who leaked it was Zoris Medvedev. This is out of your
Medvedev,
book,
that's right? The guy. Yep.
And he actually he wrote a book, and that was called something like something Disaster in the Urals or something like that.
Yeah,
which I was.
He didn't know much. I mean, he got quite a lot of it wrong. He thought that there'd been a waste dump up in the Urals, which had exploded, and it was actually something quite different. It was at the nuclear city Ozersk, where some tanks of liquids had exploded. So, I mean, he was having to assemble from radiological data, I guess, exactly what had happened. And it did take a long time to come out.
Well, let's talk about two other places, a little on the other side of the Iron Curtain, so to speak. One is was known as Windscale back in the day, and the other is Rocky Flats here in the United States. Because these are cases where I think there's a lot of criticism, or there's been a lot of criticism of the former Soviet Union in terms of its secrecy around its nuclear disasters, whether it was the one in the Ural Mountains or whether it was Chernobyl 30 years later. But there seems to be a similar shroud of secrecy cloaking the disasters that have happened here in the West.
The Windscale fire, a certain amount of public information eventually came out from that. It took several days while the fire was burning and nobody was told. But, you know, eventually people learned a certain amount. But there was a radioactive cloud that spread right across Britain, and the public was told that no, it had blown the other way, and we might still be none the wiser. But some Dutch people across the North Sea measured the radiation and said, "Excuse me, the wind seems to be going the other way." It was 30 years before we learned that a particularly dangerous isotope called polonium-210 was in the cloud, and that was kept a secret for a long time because at the time Britain and America weren't talking to each other about the nuclear technology they were using, and the British didn't want the Americans to know that we were manufacturing polonium inside the Windscale reactor. So there's a whole series of layers of secrecy, not just keeping things secret from the Soviets, but keeping those things secret from each other, that meant that the true risks from that fire were not revealed for a long time. We now think that probably several dozen people died, maybe several hundreds. And then at Rocky Flats, again, this is a secret nuclear fabrication plant turning the plutonium produced at Hanford into essentially grapefruit-size pits, as they were called, which are at the heart of nuclear weapons. And they were fabricating tens of thousands of these at the Rocky Flats plant. And they had a fire there which involved releases of plutonium into the surrounding environment in 1957. And again, you know, very little, that was kept secret because the workers at the plant were told that they had to tell their families that they were manufacturing not weapons, but household chemical liquids, sort of cleanup stuff. The secrecy, especially at that time during the Cold War, was endemic. And to be honest, it hasn't all gone away. When they had the Japanese meltdown at the Fukushima power plant after the tsunami in 2011, it was several weeks before anybody wanted to tell the Japanese people exactly what was going on. So there were huge panics. Even scientists in the local universities didn't know what radiation was going up out of the power plants or how much was falling onto the ground. There was no real reason why that should have been the case. It was just endemic secrecy. And I'm afraid it's one of the Achilles heels of the industry. It probably has its origins in the Cold War and the nuclear weapons activities, but it seems to have spread on into civilian nuclear power activities. And of course, it's made the public very skeptical and very cynical about these activities and about any reassurances that they're given by scientists about how safe nuclear power could be. And so, of course, you know, that all feeds on itself. So public tend to react in a quite an alarmist manner to any concern about nuclear issues. So that tends to make that the people involved in the nuclear activities even more secretive and less likely to be open. You get a kind of cumulative effect, which is pretty toxic in terms of public perceptions about nuclear power, as much as it can be toxic for in radiologically.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Fred Pierce, who's author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. Well, when you talk about people maybe overreacting to radioactive concerns, I'm thinking here we live 200 miles downstream from Hanford Nuclear Reservation, one of the most toxic, contaminated spots in the world. And I've spent a bunch of time out there myself, actually, and have been researching it and following it since the early 80s. And it's in a very alarming place to live downstream from. And my reaction often is, how can you be too concerned about it? Because for one thing, we still don't know everything. I mean, there have been stories that come up in the news year after year. This latest toxin has been discovered at Hanford. The radioactive plume is now this close to the Columbia River. It used to be we were just concerned about radioactivity. Then it turned out there were an amazing array, a soup of incredibly toxic chemicals that were also finding their way to the Columbia River. So my question is, how can we be too concerned when there is so much to be alarmed about?
Well, there is a lot to be alarmed about, and some of it, I mean, they're spending billions of dollars a year just to try and contain it all. And I suppose you could say that most of the time they're successful, but they don't know how to handle the waste in the those huge tanks that are sitting there full of very liquid, very highly radioactive plutonium containing liquids, huge amounts that are seeping into the soil and seeping towards the Columbia River, as you say. They're sort of rushing to try and handle that. They're many years, indeed decades, behind in trying to put together a treatment plant that would make these liquids more stable, less likely to sort of flow out of control anywhere. And yes, stuff's got into the Columbia River. The levels are not high in terms of, you know, sort of nuclear disaster levels, but these are toxins which are going to be lasting for thousands, tens of thousands of years. So I think the risks, until something goes badly wrong, or unless something goes badly wrong, the risks to individuals living downstream, downwind, are day-to-day quite low, but there is always a risk of something going wrong, and there is always that long time frame of putting into the environment things that are going to be sticking around for a long time. So I have no question that we have to be very concerned about the long-term operation or the ability of us to manage these things long-term. You know, who knows what will happen further out. We really have to be very serious about that without getting, overwhelmed by fear about day-to-day radiation, which, as of now, the risks are, day-to-day quite low, but that doesn't mean that something couldn't go wrong.
But there are.
I think that applies to nuclear power in general. You know, nuclear power plants, for instance, are day-to-day pretty safe, but we know from Chernobyl and Fukushima that if things go wrong, they go really badly wrong.
And actually, Three Mile Island wasn't much of a picnic either, as I understand. And it's debatable about just how much the consequences of that were. Well, I want to get back to Hanford. I want to talk a lot about Hanford today, partly because you didn't spend very much time in the book about it, which I was wondering why you only gave it two and a half pages. And I wasn't sure if you've actually visited it, because it wasn't clear from your description that you'd actually been there, or if you were just...
No, I didn't. I attempted to visit the site. They were not keen on me basically as a foreigner, actually, as a Brit. If I'd been American, they would have taken me around.
Let me on anytime I want, actually. I've been on there a bunch of times. They just keep letting me back. And actually, I just kind of want to just sum up, you know, my experience at Hanford between 1982 and the most recent time I've been there. Mm-hmm. And in 1982, they were touting it as going to be the permanent waste repository for all the nuclear waste in the world. And they wanted to put it into this mountain called Gable Mountain. And they had dug this mining tunnel through it, and they had this railroad tracks, and took me on a tour of that. And it was also a sacred spot to the tribes in that area. And the tribes were really up in arms about it, the Yakima in particular. Mm. And a lot of the environmentalists were really concerned. And there were all kinds of geological issues about why this was not going to be a safe place. It ultimately didn't wind up being a safe place. Also, on that trip to Hanford, they were talking about vitrification was going to be the key to storage. It was going to be turning all the waste into glass. And then I was back there the next year, and they were still kind of saying the same story, but they were kind of backing away from being a permanent waste repository. And then I didn't go back for it, I guess it was almost 20 years. And at that point, Hanford was touting itself as one of the great wildlife refuges, and kind of like Chernobyl, I guess. And that, you know, it's the last stretch, the Hanford Reach is the last stretch of the Columbia River south of the United States-Canadian border, which is undammed. And so it's a major salmon fishery, and it's one of the reasons why there's still salmon in the Columbia River. So they were touting that. They had a lot more safety protocols than they'd had when I'd been there in the early 80s. I had to sit and watch this whole video before I went on. And then there was like this series of signals you get, and one of them, one blast of the whistle meant run like hell. You know, there was like nothing else you could do. There was no shelter in place, even though they tried that last year when they had the accident or the collapse of the tunnel. But vitrification was still being talked about. And at that point, it seemed like vitrification was being seen as like really it was a working option. But what was interesting when I talked to people who were a little more forthcoming in 2002 than they had been in 1982 or 83, that they were saying that the problem was that the presidential administrations kept changing in those 20 years. And every time there was a change of presidential administration, they went back to zero. And so all these things that they've been trying since 1982 had just kind of been shoved to the side, and they kept starting from the beginning over and over again, which is why they spend so many billions of dollars every year and still have nothing. They have barely cleaned up any more than they did back in 1982. And in fact, they seem to discover more and more problems. And one last point I'll make before I ask you a question. I interviewed a bunch of these people around a table, and there was a guy who was representing Flora, which was the main contractor for the cleanup. And he was talking about how they used to throw low-level nuclear waste in unlined pits, which actually I knew that, but he was saying we no longer do that. And then I talked to Tom Carpenter with Hanford Challenge about 2 years later, and he said they were doing it for years after they talked to you. So that's an example again of why people don't trust the nuclear industry.
You bet, you bet. There is, especially about nuclear waste issues, there remains a great deal of secrecy. You're right, vitrification remains the number one plan for dealing with liquid wastes. And it's not a stupid idea. I mean, containing liquid is very difficult. It flows, it will find, if there's any crack in any tank or facility, and cracks form quite easily if you've got a very sort of viscous, or if you've got a very corrosive liquid, it'll find its way out. So vitrifying it to make it into a solid kind of glass structure is not a dumb thing to do. But they've been working on this for a long time, as you say, at Hanford. And I think the technicians will tend to blame the politicians when actually they just had huge technical problems in doing this. And they're still way behind schedule. And I'm sure there have been funding problems and shortages, but basically they're dealing with it's very difficult. And when they vitrified it, I mean, then they're going to have to, what do we do with this vitrified waste? And the answer to that remains, if you talk to government scientists, remains putting it in Yucca Mountain, even though the Yucca Mountain project has been brought to a halt now. President Trump would like to revive it, but I don't think the Nevada politicians are probably going to allow him to do that. So that remains, the whole series of very expensive options remain sort of hanging around without being operationalized. It's really a problem without end.
So I want to talk about those spent fuel rods, because in this country, and I think around the world, we're closing down more and more nuclear power plants. And I guess an example to me of the way we deal with the problem, like we had a nuclear power plant about 50 miles north of Portland on the Columbia River called Trojan, and it shut down in the early 90s. And then sometime in the late 90s, or early, I forget when it was, sometime in the last 20 years or so, they took down the cooling tower. So therefore, Hanford, Trojan is gone. There's no cooling tower. You can't see it anymore when you're driving along the Columbia River. But the spent fuel rods are still sitting in cooling pools, which they've been there since Trojan opened, which was like in 1978, and they and it closed in 1992. So actually, the cooling tower was not a health hazard like the spent fuel rods are. However, you could see the cooling tower, and it was a reminder that there were spent fuel rods in the tank in the pools. And now we don't have any reminder of that.
Yeah, that's right. I think we're reaching this point where more and more nuclear power plants are being shut down, and we're being seduced to believe that once they're not working, that they're not a problem. But as you say, many of the plants, even decades on, the sites still have spent fuel sitting, keeping cool in those like swimming pool size operations. Otherwise, they'd bubble up and they'd boil and they'd explode. 35 states in the U.S. currently have these interim stores. Some of them are in tanks. Some of them are in kind of air-conditioned interim stores. But they're all sitting there waiting for somewhere permanent for this stuff to go. They're all called interim stores, but they're interim forever, really, until we get either Yucca Mountain or some other repository. So, the problem is that because nobody wants a final repository in their backyard, which is quite understandable, it's kind of in everybody's backyard. Because, almost every state or 35 states have this stores of nuclear waste in various forms sitting there in a supposedly interim state, but it begins to look increasingly permanent. And that's not, that's not sensible, it's not safe, it's not sustainable, it incurs risks and costs on future generations. It's really just a disgraceful way for an industry to be managed. And the U.S. is not alone. As I said, all around the world, similar situations. Britain is shutting down nuclear reactors. Most of all our coastlines really have got a nuclear reactor on them somewhere, and they're going to be sitting there for many decades to come. And again, there are no ultimate resting places for the fuel.
Well, you speak about it being in everybody's backyard, but if we do have the permanent repository, let's say it's at Yucca Mountain, there's going to be all these trucks carrying these spent fuel rods and other waste on the highways across the United States. So it's going to be in everybody's highways. So how do we...
That's true.
Yeah, that seems to be a really big danger, too.
I agree. I mean, we're not in an ideal place. We're stuck with this stuff. We just have to, at some point, kind of swallow very hard, decide what is the least risky option, and start doing it. I think failing to take those decisions is maximizing the potential risks. So I'm not saying that, maybe trucks isn't the way to do it. Maybe there's another better way. There's a lot of work got to be done to think about this before we come up with a final solution. But we really have to address it. And the problem is because it's so technically difficult and politically difficult, we're just kind of not doing it at all. And we're just kind of crossing our fingers and sort of, humming a tune.
Well, one of my concerns, this was back number of years ago, there was talk about there were a lot of nuclear moratoriums until there was a permanent waste repository that was sited, and then after that we could start building nuclear power plants again. That was some people's positions, and my concern at the time was we have so much waste already, and I was also doubtful that we're going to find a decent repository. How can you think about ever making any more of this? So how do we argue that? And you seem to be pretty hopeful that there'll be no more nuclear expansion, at least on the commercial side. But how do we maintain that the lessons we have of what we don't know what to do with all this waste, how can that be a lesson of us not to make any more?
I think it needs to be a lesson. I mean, I think, public remains pretty hostile in most places to the idea of new nuclear plants. At any rate, when they've got them, sometimes they think, well, there are jobs there and, it's business and they will accept them. But the idea of new nuclear plants is really nobody around the world wants those, and very few places have the kind of authoritarian politics which will allow them to be built. Another issue with nuclear power now is it's simply very expensive. And the costs are going up, whereas the costs of alternatives are going down. The only good thing you can say about nuclear power, from my perspective, is that it is a low-carbon source of energy. So if, like me, you're very concerned about global warming and climate change, it has a certain attraction in that regard. But it is now true that there are many other, even lower carbon sources of energy, wind power, solar power, and so on, that are coming on the scene. And while nuclear power gets more and more expensive, renewable power gets cheaper and cheaper. So I don't think, I can imagine a technological future in which we go a bundle on nuclear power. I think it's a dying industry. I think it's, and I'm glad that it's a dying industry, certainly in anything like its present form. It is not sustainable. It's expensive. It's environmentally dangerous. There are all the issues connected with nuclear proliferation. We can't get away from the fact that what we produce out of the back of these power plants, the spent fuel, contains plutonium, which can be extracted and turned into bombs, and can be extracted and turning into bombs over thousands of years. So, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons, I certainly don't think it's a desirable way of generating our energy in future, but I also don't think it'll actually happen.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Fred Pierce, who's author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. Well, another concern that I have about cleaning up this mess we have is that there's a lot of denial about actually cleaning it up. And an example being that right now there's a controversy around the Department of Energy deciding to relabel what has been called high-level waste at Hanford to low-level waste. And so then it doesn't have to be cleaned up to the same level of carefulness that you would for high-level. And there's a big movement among the environmental community around here to stop that. But what does that say to you about the kind of denial we have about the really dangerous substances that we have proliferating all around the world?
Yeah, there are some gray areas in some of this waste. Spent fuel is undoubtedly a high level waste. Some of the liquids and other things which are contaminated with a certain amount of plutonium, I guess you can have a debate about. The extent of the risks with them, but I'm not inclined to. I don't think the nuclear industry should start having a semantic debate about exactly what counts as high-level nuclear waste. That's going to just bring even more public cynicism about their activities. So if I was a consultant talking to them, which I certainly am not, I would advise against doing anything so stupid. They should just be getting on with dealing with the waste. I think some people try and come up with sort of excuses for where they've landed up. They've landed up in a bad place, so maybe it's not quite so bad. But I think it's a pretty dumb approach. And at the end of the day, they've still got to handle this material.
Well, you mentioned in the beginning of the show about exclusion zones, and the two that you made reference to was the one in the Ural Mountains where the fires happened in the 1957. Mm-hmm. The other one, more famously, is Chernobyl, which I understand you made a brief reference to this being like a frequent site on dark tours. But I actually heard a radio piece a number of years ago about this guy who went to visit Chernobyl, and it seemed like an odd thing to do. But I wanted to talk about this as being part of the legacy of the nuclear age, that there are vast swaths of the planet that seem to be uninhabitable, though some of that is debatable. So first of all, let's just talk about some of the areas that are where human contact or human exposure is trying to be excluded, and what has happened to those areas without there being any human presence.
Well, if you take away humans, generally speaking, nature loves it. It may be a radioactive environment, and certainly around Chernobyl, it is very significantly radioactive. Or you might say the same of Hanford or the core area at Rocky Flats, not the area necessarily they want to open up to public, but the core area in the middle of that, and the area around the Fukushima accident in 2011 similarly. Wherever you take away people, wildlife moves in. Wolves are growing and bears are numbers are growing around in the area around Chernobyl. There are eagles, looking for fish in the cooling ponds around the lake, around the power plant. wherever you take away people, wildlife will move in. Now, you know, there can be some radiological risks attached for wildlife. Some people certainly reckon they found some genetic modifications for wildlife living in a radioactive environment. But at the sort of level of the individual, they kind of revel in the absence of humans. So these are kind of almost rewilding areas. Some people will talk about the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which is 20 miles in every direction from the power plant, as Europe's largest rewilding area. And there's some truth in that.
However, I also was just reading an article about how there's some concerns that there's genetic modification going on inside the animals that are being rewilded around Chernobyl, but that they, if they migrate out of the area, they may be mating with, particularly it's concerned with wolves who do migrate quite a bit, they'd be mating with non-radiological wolves and causing potential birth defects down the line. So have you heard anything about that concern?
People have theorized about that. Yes, I'm not aware of any evidence that interbreeding of that kind has happened. The evidence from humans, for instance, from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, suggests that there probably aren't many, at any rate, obvious signs of DNA damage that pass down to the next generation. But there's always a risk of that, and some people have highlighted that. So I wouldn't, you know, I think we simply have to do the research to find out what's happened. It's a rather scary, you know, real-life experiment going on there. So let's monitor it, and let's monitor it with, you know, let's not necessarily get too carried away with the fears. They may be rather overblown, by comparison with the damage that is done to wildlife by regular human activity, whether it's sort of hunters or fishers or the pollution that we cause from our other activities. It may be that, you know, the radiation from the exclusion area is not any worse, and maybe rather less than that. So I'll admit to being a little bit sanguine about that, but you know, it is an experiment, and we don't ultimately know. It may be that a few generations down the line, some of these apparently relatively minor genetic changes do kind of extend in the population of wildlife in the exclusion zone there. It may be that there are some contamination, if you like, with people with wildlife outside the exclusion zone. On the other hand, if there are sort of so many more wolves than there would have been otherwise, you know, that's a plus. So we, you know, kind of have to look at it both ways, I guess.
Well, the last thing I wanted to talk about is the concept of sacrifice zones, which is a big concern around many activities that humans have been doing here on the planet for the last couple hundred years. But there is discussion about some of these zones, like around Chernobyl, like in the Ural Mountains, like Hanford, and not to mention we haven't really touched upon all the nuclear tests that went on in the South Pacific and vast stretches of the South Pacific, which are uninhabitable, that there is like maybe a debate. Because you sort of mentioned my friend Dan Sears, who, by the way, he's based in Portland, not in Seattle, as you wrote in the book, but he's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and you quote him as talking about how Hanford needs to be cleaned up so it can be returned to be the incredible, pristine, very resource-rich area that it was before it became a nuclear reservation. And then you quote from somebody else who says that we just have to walk away from some of these areas because they're uninhabitable. So how do we balance that debate?
It's very difficult. Morally, we certainly shouldn't be leaving areas that are uninhabitable for future generations. I don't think that's an acceptable thing to do morally. But whether it is actually practically possible to clean up some areas is another question. And whether in cleaning them up, you might, with our current methods of waste disposal, creating more problems elsewhere. I was quite struck by, and that, as you say, that plays out very strongly at Hanford, where there are different debates about, or there are debate about the extent to which it can practically be cleaned up. I think it's quite clear that we should do something to permanently make sure that waters going into waters in the Columbia River are not contaminated, because that just spreads everywhere. But in terms of an area that might be contained, well, maybe we have to make some compromises. I don't know. I'm reluctant to say that, but maybe it's true. Looking internationally, I mean, there are very different approaches. So in Ukraine, around Chernobyl, the authorities there have decided to keep to create a sacrificial zone, really. They've decided they want to keep the radioactivity there. So they allow the forest to grow and absorb the radiation. They don't scrape off the soils or the vegetation. There are marshes there which are very radioactive, and they basically want to contain the radioactivity within them, because they don't want it blowing downwind, and they don't want it flowing into the rivers towards more densely populated parts of the country, including the capital, Kiev, which is not so far away. Whereas the Japanese are very keen to clean up around Fukushima. So in their exclusion zone, you see these huge pyramids of black plastic bags where they've scraped up vegetation, they've scraped up soil, especially anything which is of the surface which is radioactive, put it in these plastic bags, and they're piled up. The problem is they haven't quite worked out what to do with what's in those black plastic bags. So there are some, you know, having decided on a cleanup, they now are not quite clear what to do with the radioactive material that they've cleaned up. So, you know, so there are, and the worst case scenario would be that this becomes a bigger problem than the original hazard. I'm not saying that's the case, but there's always a risk of that kind of thing. So we do need a kind of measured response, but the moral touchstone has to be to reduce the risks to our own generations, of course, but also to future generations who might down the track be much less aware of the risks than perhaps we are today.
Well, I find one of the interesting dilemmas of something you describe around Rocky Flats in Colorado, which is not that far from Denver, that there was talk about opening a nature preserve where the contamination happened from the fire in 1957. And let's talk a little bit about what that debate was about.
Yeah, they plan to open it up this fall, in fact. That's the current plan. What they have is they had an area where the plutonium fabrication was going on, and they had a kind of buffer zone around that. And while they're not going to open up the area where the buildings were, because there's still a lot of underground stuff and, you know, it's still quite contaminated in places, I think, but the buffer zone where they say essentially it's clean, the radiological levels are very low, they want to open that up as a sort of wildlife area. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, there, you know, I've been there. There's lots of huge number of different plant species. It's rather, you know, it's landscape level. It's really rather nice there, and they want to open it up to hikers and cyclists and so on. And the Fish and Wildlife Service plans to do that this fall. Critics say, yeah, but, you know, there were these fires, particularly one in 57 and then a later one, which put some plutonium into the soil, and while the levels at the surface don't seem too high, there may be more down below, and if you've got prairie dogs and things around, they may start bringing this stuff to the surface. And then there's a whole debate about how dangerous very small amounts of plutonium, which are going to be in tiny particles that you might breathe in or something, how dangerous those might be. And there's some scientific debate about what the risks are. And so environmental scientists in the area that I met, many of them say, well, we simply shouldn't run these risks. It's crazy to allow, you know, public bringing their children in, and, you know, the children might sort of pick up dirt on the ground and they might put it in their mouth, and you know something bad might happen. And, you know, I think the public will decide what it wants to do, I suppose, but certainly that's been quite a big debate going on in that area. And, of course, all the while, this is quite a remote area north of Denver. When the plant was open, but suburbs are now moving up, there's now a huge housing development right over the fence from the reserve. So people are moving in. There are NGOs trying to track whether people who worked at the plant or their children have higher rates of cancer. And there's certainly some concerning statistics about that. So there's a whole sort of concern about whether there were risks, whether those risks might still be around in the environment, both within the area that wants to turn into reserve and indeed beyond it.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Fred Pierce, author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. Getting back to our original conversation about understanding time, how do we deal with the consequences of this multi-millennial legacy that we are faced with? And what's our responsibility to future generations to both let them know the mess that we made and to alleviate as much as possible the burden on them?
Well, I mean, you described it. I mean, that is our responsibility to do that, to find ways. I mean, psychologists have been working out, you know, exactly what indicators could we come up with that future generations with different cultures might be able to understand, you know, things that you could put in the ground that they would, you know, a bit like the sort of skull and crossbow signs that we put up for dangerous areas now, but something that might be understood in a similar way in 10,000 years time. It's very hard to work out how to do that, but it was certainly we ought to be doing it, whether we're talking about areas with sort of background contamination, buried waste in the soil such as Rocky Flats, or indeed Hanford, with those trenches full of all sorts of things that we don't really know what is in some of those trenches, and the contaminated soil there. Or indeed, if we finally do the Yucca Mountain Repository, you know, the signs are going to have to be pretty big and pretty obvious there, because that will be where the great majority of the radioactivity in America's nuclear waste would end up. It's pretty understandable why the people in Nevada don't really want that. But if it does go there, then, you know, boy, we've got to make every effort that we can to make sure that people now and in future are not put in harm's way. That's the ultimate challenge, is to make sure that people are not put in harm's way by these technologies that we developed in a great rush during and immediately after the Cold War. I mean, that was a really scary period when we were producing vast amounts of radioactive material to put into weapons, and of course the weapons are still kicking around and could blow us all up. You know, we've left ourselves just a horrific legacy in many respects, civil and military, in terms of the waste, in terms of the fallout from accidents. And that was the purpose of the book, was to explore that, not to take sides too much, but have a very clear eye about, you know, what we've done, the legacy we've created, and to begin to think how to clean up, and how to clean up for our generation, but for future generations too.
Well, Fred, thanks very much for joining us today, and thanks for writing the book, and hopefully opening a few eyes.
Well, it was a bit scary, but I hope it's enjoyable.
I wouldn't say it's enjoyable, but it's interesting. Okay, thanks a lot. Today we've been talking with Fred Pierce, who's author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll hear a keynote address that Sandra Steingraber gave at the Permanent People's Tribunal session on human rights, fracking, and climate change that happened in Corvallis last May. And after that, I'm going to be taking off for the next few weeks. I'll come back the week after Labor Day. And so we're going to be running a series of reruns of some of my favorite shows from the last few months, and also a special that was produced by a friend of mine for WCUW Community Radio in Worcester, Massachusetts, that's about foreclosures. And we'll be hearing that in a couple weeks. And I might come back with a couple other special things in the meantime, but everything will be pre-recorded until September. So have a good summer. Take care during this heat wave, and we'll hope for some nicer weather in the following weeks. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Mojo Nixon and Jello Biafra, Atomic Power. Thanks for listening.